Good morning. Okay, we are in part three of Joshua and archaeology. We're going to make some progress this week, and then this will end the archaeological section for a couple of weeks, and we'll move on to things in a more biblical perspective and less archaeological. But this morning, I want to start out by telling you one of the classes that I was required to take in law school. It was a class called Legal Research and Writing. And I can remember when I had to take the class thinking, well, this is rather stupid. I know how to write, and actually I can research fairly well. Why would I need to take a class to teach me that now that I'm in law school? Well, it turns out it was a very important class for me to take because it had some incredible lessons that have affected the way I approach many, many things that matter. And here's one of the textbooks that we had. It's called The Blue Book. And Ken Shortreed, I saw Mike Moriarty, I saw Mary, some of the other lawyers here, you probably had the same book, regardless of the law school you went to. This is a book that's put out, I think, by Harvard, but it's either that or Texas Tech. I'm always getting those two confused. Except Harvard has a better football program. This year. The Blue Book is important because what it does is it gives you a form that you're required to follow when you put a citation or a footnote or a reference to something. That's very important in law because in law, you're not allowed to simply stand up and say, Your Honor, this is the way I think it should be. The judge has to make his ruling based upon earlier rulings and earlier laws. That's called precedent. The judge is not supposed to cavalierly sit up there and say, hey, I think I'd like the law to be this, and then make it up. The judges are taught and the lawyers are taught to follow the law that has come before. Does that make sense? And since that's what we have to do, you have to cite the law, and you have to cite it in a form that's acceptable so that anybody can go find it to see if you're being honest and straightforward. So this book is one that we're done, and we were taught that you've got to have a proper citation. You've got to have a proper reference in a proper form for the precedent or the law that you're trying to work through. You with me so far? All right, I got to tell you one more thing that came out of this class that's relevant to us today. We were taught as a cardinal rule in the practice of law that you're to always choose what is called a primary source over what is called a secondary source. Those words may be familiar to you, but to some they will not be familiar. So I want to make sure we understand the difference between a primary source and a secondary source. Primary means first. Your primary school is your first school. Primary means first. Secondary means second. You always want to try to find and reference the original source material, not somebody who says somebody said something. So here's how it breaks down. You might have, I can say to a judge, John said blah, blah, blah. But if I'm going to do that, I need to have gotten that from John. John needs to have said it. I need to go find John. So when I quote John, I need to be able to give the judge a source that is John saying it. It does not do for me the primary source. It does not do for me to say John said and then tell the judge, I know this because Luce Clinton told me John said it. Then that's only as reliable as Luce Clinton, and she's not in front of the judge. And so the judge or the jury, they have no way of knowing if Luce heard correctly or not. So you always have to go to the primary source. You've just gotten a legal education. Go forth and practice law. That's a secondary source. I can't go to a second source. I need to go to the first source for the material. Now let's put this into Bible terms. So in Bible terms, it would be something like this. The Bible says, and if I'm going to quote to you the Bible, I need to give you the Bible verse. It doesn't do me any good to quote to you the Bible and then say, see David Fleming's sermon. Now, Pastor Fleming is a reliable source, yes. But why would I ever offer you a secondary source when we can do the primary source? Let's go look at the Bible and see if the Bible really says it. You with me? So those are the two things we learned. You always seek to use primary sources and you cite that. You put a footnote to it. You identify it so that people can go find it and see if you're right, if you're accurate, if you're being candid, if you've put it in the right context. Now, this is our introduction today because I am going to express to you my concerns over the failure of scholars to do this. Because not everybody is in the legal profession. And we're taught in law school, the reason it's of paramount importance is because law is the structure of society. And if the law is not what the law should be, and if the law is not kept, not only are people's lives in danger, but society itself can crumble. So it's so important. We need to be very diligent, and we need to do this and do this well. Now, I would suggest to you, if there's any area that trumps the law in importance and the need for you to be precise and the need for you to be detailed and the need for you to be accurate, it's the Lord and studying His Word and His revelation to us. And so I get a little frustrated. Now, last week we left off with this chart. We had this chart, and it gave us all of these different towns that we had looked at that had the check marks. And I said, we have looked at every one of these towns Joshua talks about and shown that archaeology testifies that they were legitimate towns with populations that fit the story that we have within the Bible. I left off Jericho and Ai because I said they deserve solo attention. I don't know if we're going to get back to Ai. It's easily dealt with, but Jericho is the one that I want to spend this class on. And so your written materials deal with Jericho. And the way I want to deal with Jericho today is I want to first look at the biblical account, and let's make sure that we're on the same page with what the Bible says, and then I want to look at the archaeology. The biblical account, though, I'm going to be fairly brief on. This class has got a little more archaeology and a little less Bible because most of us have familiarity with the biblical account. The biblical account is not what Dale Hearn sent me in a cartoon. Looks like some sort of parade. That's not quite what was happening. The biblical account is the Israelites have just lost their leader for over 40 years. They've lost Moses. Moses is the one God talked to. Moses is the one who got the law. Moses is the one who interceded on behalf of the Israelites when they were sinning. Moses was the one who was able to hold up a serpent and stop the disease from spreading and the plague from spreading through the camp. Moses was the one who got water when they needed water, got bread or manna when they needed manna, got quail when they needed food. Moses was the man that got, had the hotline into God. He had the red phone, and Moses was dead just when they were going in to invade the promised land. Now, I don't know what people were thinking back then because they didn't write it down, but I can tell you what I'd be thinking. So Joshua's in charge now, huh? I wonder if he has the same hotline into the Lord that Moses did. Because if I'm going into battle, I'd kind of like to know that El Capitan knows what's going on. The whole thing was, we don't have to do this. The Lord's going to do it through us. And the Lord's man is gone. So that's what I'd be wondering. And I tell you that because I find it more than fascinating that God gives this absolutely elaborate, unusually non-military process for the very first town to be taken. Now, Jericho, we know, was not a monstrously big town. It wasn't an important town. It wasn't an incredibly populous town. But it's the first town the Israelites got as they crossed the Jordan River. And so Joshua hears from the Lord that this is what you got to do. The people need to march around that town every day for 7 days. And the seventh day, they need to march around it seven times. And then the priests need to blow the horns. And when they do, the wall's going to come open, come down. And the Israelites are going to take the town. Sure enough, that's what they do. The seventh day, the horns blow. The walls come, wall, singular, comes tumbling down. And the Israelites go through. And they kill everybody there. Now, this is a story that archaeologists were really excited about. And when archaeology first got started, this was the fundraiser. You know, have any of you ever been hit up for money for an event or anything? It's the strangest thing. People have been doing that for a long time. And a big hook for them is to say, you know the story of the walls of Jericho? We're going to go find those babies. Crumble down. Would you help finance our expedition? And it made it real easy. So in the 1800s, people were digging at Jericho. In the 1900s, people were digging in Jericho. There was a fellow named John Garstang who dug at Jericho in the 1930s and reported to the world, I have found the walls of Jericho that came tumbling down. They date at the right time. Here they are. And everybody caught on like wildfire until Kathleen Kenyon in 1950s went to do the major excavation and said, time out. Those walls you found that you told everybody about, a few hundred years too soon. That was not at the time of Joshua. And she put together some fairly compelling evidence that said that. And so you've got now a Joshua story in the Bible, and you've got archaeologists trying to figure out where is the evidence to support this biblical story. And it's really fascinating. I've had a ball preparing this lesson because I took all of these books and I put them in chronological order for when they were written. And I started at the beginning and I marched all the way through to the end. Some of them were not worth reading, and I'll readily admit I discounted a number of them because it's just, and you don't have to read all 6.5 feet. Some of them you just read the section on Jericho. But I read through these for you. And one of the questions that was in the back of my mind as I was reading this is, and you'll see why in a minute, but why in the book of Joshua does this story of Jericho get front page? Because it is. It's the front page headline. It gets more space for a minuscule battle than anything else. It gets this elaborate explanation. When most of the battles, it doesn't give any explanation. It's just, we went up, we took that city. We went up, we took that city. We went up, we took that city. But for Jericho, we know exactly what they did. And I would suggest to you the reason why is because it was a contemporary account, an accurate account, and it confirmed to the people that the Lord was behind Joshua. I mean, that's not the kind of military campaign you dream up on your own. And whether God just took that earthen wall down, or whether there was an earthquake that caused it to slide down, and God had the earthquake timed at the precise moment it needed to be, I don't care how he did it. But it's pretty confirming to me when Joshua says on the seventh day, we'll march around it seven times, you'll blow the horns, and the walls are coming down because the Lord is behind this, and it happens. I'd follow the guy on to the next battle. I'd say, okay, transition of power complete. I can, commander-in-chief, you say jump, I'll say how high. And so I think it makes sense. Now, I read these books, and that question is plaguing me because most people don't answer that question when they look at this stuff. So let's set the Bible story aside And let's move to the archaeology for a moment. Archaeology. Here's a book. This was the last book on my shelf. 2009-2010. It's by Don Benjamin. It's entitled Stones and Stories. Let's put it up here. Now, do you know why I brought this book? I could very easily tell you what the book said, and then I'm what? Secondary source. But instead, I want you to have the benefit of the primary source. It's the reason we have this Elmo up here. It's the reason I bring these books. It's the reason I put the Xeroxes up here. I want you to be able to see and not just say, well, hey, my Sunday school teacher said. I want you to be able to say, time out. I've seen some of that stuff. And that's why we do these handouts. And with these handouts, I give you footnotes. And I tell you exactly where I get this material so you can go find it and see whether it's there or not. And so can any cynic who finds us on the internet. Well, this fella, Don Benjamin, looks like a nice enough fella. I've never met him. My friend Charles Mickey studied with him at Rice. But I haven't. He teaches biblical and Near Eastern studies at Arizona State University. This is one of his textbooks. He uses this. If you're a student at Arizona State University and you take Don Benjamin for his class on archaeology in the Bible, this will be your textbook, Stones and Stories, an introduction to archaeology and the Bible. Well, he writes about Jericho. It's in this section on page 92, Stones versus Stories. Stories versus stones, because he says there's a difference. An ongoing challenge for cultural historians working in the world of the Bible is how to resolve contradictions between material remains, that means archaeology, and written remains. By that he means the Bible. How to resolve contradictions between archaeology and the Bible. For example, the preached tradition understands the books of Joshua and Judges to be a description of how miraculous military victories confirmed the Hebrews' faith in Yahweh. Nonetheless, Kathleen Kenyon, 1906 to 1978. He must know what he's talking about. He knew the year she was born and died. Who excavated Jericho from 1952 to 1959. Actually, not totally right. The excavations ended before 59. She was still writing up some things. But I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Could not confirm that there was a city at the site when the Hebrews were in Syria, Palestine. Instead, the material remains indicate that the Hyksos city of Jericho was destroyed in 1350 BCE, more than 250 years before Joshua, 1200 to 1000 BCE. And the site remained abandoned until 716, when Hezekiah of Judah rebuilt it. Now, I'll skip down and let you look for that footnote. It's not there. He didn't give a footnote. We look at this, and this is a secondary source. And he doesn't give us, he says he's getting it from the primary source, but he doesn't tell us where he got it, does he? And I might also add, he's not all that hot at math. 1350 minus 1200 is not 250 years. But hey, let's not quibble over who killed who. So I think, well, where did you get this from? You who are educating the masses? Well, in the back of his book, he's got a bibliography. The bibliography, of course, are his references. And on page 331 of his bibliography are the books by Kathleen Kenyon he recommends. Well, I can tell you with almost certainty that her book in 1952 is not her analysis of what she did through 1959. Similarly, her book on Samaria Sebasti III, The Objects, in 1957, has nothing to do with Jericho and her dig there. Her book, Archaeology in the Holy Land, 1960, it deals with Jericho among some other things, but it doesn't give her detailed findings. Her Royal Cities of the Old Testament, Jericho wasn't one of those. Then she's got a collection of essays that were edited by someone else after she died. The Bible and Recent Archaeology. That's it. Now that frustrates me. It frustrates me for a number of reasons. A, this is serious stuff to me. Don't sit there and tell me the Bible is a contradiction with archaeology and not give me the site for the archaeology you claim contradicts it. Excuse me, I get a little frustrated. Switch to lawyer mode. I will tell you this, though. I happen to have the writings of Kathleen Kenyon that he doesn't cite. The writings that actually deal with what she found at Jericho. Books like, Digging Up Jericho. So I went to see if Kathleen Kenyon, in fact, said these things. Did Kathleen Kenyon, in fact, say, there's no city, it's all over at 1350? Well, here's what Kathleen Kenyon said. Kathleen Kenyon said things. I'm starting on page 260. She said, she starts out talking about the tombs. You see, there are two things that are being excavated that we'll talk about here. They excavated, let's go to do it like this. There's a mound, a Jericho mound. Okay, and it's in the middle of the Dead Sea Valley. It's near the Dead Sea. And this is a mound because Jericho's been around since 8 or 9,000 B.C. They've dug all the way down and found things that they date that far back. And what would happen is some marauders would come over and they'd destroy the village and knock down and there'd be a fight and everything. Or an earthquake would come and destroy it and they'd just build on top of it. We talked about that one other time. They didn't have bulldozers to come scrape it clean. And, Fred Flintstone did not have a bulldozer. So they just would build on top. And then they'd build on top. And then they'd build on top. And finally, you're up there. And then when they dig, they can dig down and see all these layers. And it all works fine ordinarily. There's another way they can find evidence, though, and that is some Canaanites, like these folks, had tombs, and they would bury their dead, and with their dead, some artifacts. So you can go back, and she says things like, a review of the tomb, of the finds made in the tombs, suggests, as with the tombs found in more recent excavations, the main use ceased at the end of the Middle Bronze Age. That's early in the 16th century B.C. When you read 16th century, think 1500 B.C. In a limited number of instances among tombs on the west side of town, the tombs were then reused between 1400 B.C. and around 1350 to 1325. That C means around. Could have been a little earlier. Could have been a little later. Now, why does Benjamin just say 1350 when she says 1325, maybe even later? Let's go further. She talks about on the tell, that's the word that means on top of this mound that we're digging on. Professor Garstang, that's the fellow who dug 15 years before her, found a small quantity of pottery of the same period and a building. And she starts talking about the building here in a minute. She says that there was occupation of the town during the 14th century, that's the 1300s, is shown by the finds in these tombs. We don't know it by the mound, but we've looked in the tombs, and we can see they were burying people in the 1300s. So they must have been living on the mounds. Now, why can't we find evidence on the mound? In the interest of time, we'll go through this rather quickly. If you don't follow it, just read the lesson. The houses of the late Bronze Age Jericho Those are the houses that we would believe should be there, have almost entirely disappeared. We've seen over most of the summit of the mound, even the houses of the certainly populous Middle Bronze Age town have vanished. Only the Early Bronze Age remains. Here's what she's saying. There was a mound, and when people came in and conquered, or when there was an earthquake, they'd just rebuild on top. But there were times where the village was abandoned, either because of a settlement issue or because of an earthquake or because of a conquering, and there wasn't anybody to build on top. Do you know what happens when you have a bunch of clay and sand elevated above the ground and nothing goes on top and you've got no vegetation and nothing to hold it in? And you have massive winds and you have a rainy season where there are torrential downpours? It might shock you to find out, but erosion takes place. And she says that very clearly. She doesn't say, there's no late Bronze Age town, it never existed, it's made up. What she says is, it's a sad fact that of the town walls of the late Bronze Age, within which period the attack by the Israelites must fall by any dating, not a trace remains. Now that doesn't mean that they weren't there to start with. I've built sandcastles by the ocean with my children. I have a picture. Can we go to the PowerPoint? Let's zip through a couple of these. Oh, yeah, this is my thing. I was very frustrated. No footnotes. They're really not hard. I'll show him how to do them. Dame Kathleen Kenyon. By the way, Kenyon said blah, 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 and he doesn't go to Kenyon because he probably hasn't read Kenyon. If he does, has read her, then he's not being fair to her. He uses a secondary source. Let's skip through this. Oh, that's the mound. Okay? The rain goes that way. It goes, and the wind goes that way. Let me orient you. This is kind of deceptive. North is down below us. Okay? The top of the screen is south. So this over here is west. This is the Mediterranean. These are the mountains there. The wind blows from the Mediterranean, and the rains come over that way. And then it hits the mound, and then it washes towards the Jordan River and dumps into the Dead Sea. Okay. So you've got the rain and you've got the wind and you've got it blowing there. Now, I got to tell you, we'll come back to this slide, but I want you to see, oh, that's not the sandcastle I built. Hang on. Okay. I have built sandcastles, and I'm here to tell you, having built sandcastles, you can go there the next day and not a trace remains. Do you know why? The water washes them away. Okay. Now, here's what happens. So she says, let's go back to Kathleen Kenyon, Dame Kathleen Kenyon. Her dad was like the head of the British Museum. Incredible lady. Never got married. Spent all of her life doing this stuff. She said, the erosion, which has destroyed much of the defenses, has already been described. It will be remembered the summit of the Middle Bronze Age rampart only survives in one place. The late Bronze Age town must have either reused it, or a new wall may have been built above it, and nothing remains of it. Okay, here's what she's saying. She's saying you have the Early Bronze Age, then there's a Middle Bronze Age that was built on top of it, but it's all gone except one building. We know there was a Middle Bronze Age because you got all the tombs. You got a bunch of Middle Bronze Age dead people with a bunch of Middle Bronze Age pottery in their tombs. So we know it was very populated, but you can't tell it by archaeology because it's totally gone. And the reason it's gone, she says, is because when that Middle Bronze Age population ended, it was never resettled. For 200 years it lay dormant. And in 200 years, it wiped away everything except the foundation of one building. Okay, then it gets resettled. A late Bronze Age settlement comes in. That's the settlement for Joshua. When Joshua destroys it, according to the Bible and according to the archaeology, it's not rebuilt for 400 years. She says, if we lost the Middle Bronze Age, that segment in 200 years of erosion. Can you imagine 400 years? There's nothing that remains of it. That's what she says. She doesn't say what this fella says she says. She doesn't draw any of these conclusions. But now, here's the fun part. So I read all of this and my assessment is, okay, that makes sense. It makes sense. But why aren't scientists looking at this? So I keep reading. I find guys like Israel Finkelstein that we've talked about before, who doesn't believe in the Exodus and any of this stuff. He's on Discovery TV. I read his book. He says the idea of erosion is a joke. And it's just a romantic mirage, he calls it. That there was. So I'm sitting there saying, okay, well, you're not a geologist, but there are some. So let's go get the geology primary sources that talk about erosion, that have done the studies that show when erosion takes place, when it doesn't take place, how long it takes, and what the factors are. Because these guys do that and gals do that work. And the amazing thing is that you'll find in your papers, because I've quoted it and cited it page and line, you'll find they talk not only about erosion profiles, but within these textbooks, which I might add have footnotes, well-written textbooks that give you exact page and line cites. Here's one of my favorites here. They'll say things like, this. Mud brick walls, and that's what was at Jericho. These weren't walls made out of stone. They were made out of unfired clay that had weeds in it and straw in it. They just took chunks of dirt and formed them into bricks so that they'd stand on top of each other. And you don't think that rain and wind in 400 years without any vegetation or cover is not going to wash that? Oh, that's silly. Anyway, mud brick walls and structures which are not maintained and or are abandoned often decay, erode, and can be redeposited as colluvium. And he gives Goldberg his 1979 A article, which can be difficult to differentiate from the original intact mud brick. Mud brick or rammed earth buildings, which is what they had, are particularly susceptible to erosion by rainfall, not rising groundwater in our case, precipitation of salts, maybe. But this is not rocket science. This is well-accepted science. And you read through these quotations from these guys, and you walk away and you say, okay, this makes sense to me. I emailed this paper out to this archaeologist that I've struck up this relationship with, who's working the dig in Gath over in Israel. And he emailed me back and he said, I'm saving your paper because I'm tired of people misquoting Kathleen Kenyon and I need your references to show them they're wrong. I have not written him back and said that makes me a secondary source. Instead, let me send you her book. Instead, I'll just say, at least I cited her, you know. But he told me to tell you something. He said, please remind your class of something else too. I said, what's that? Oh, I didn't say that because it was all in one email. But in my brain, I said, well, what's that? And he said that we have made an illogical leap if we assume that the late Bronze Jerichoans, or whatever you'd call them, built new walls. If 200 years doesn't erode away the prior walls that were there from the Middle Bronze Age, they'd have just used those. So when you see Middle Bronze Age walls, or don't see them, that may have been the same walls. If they couldn't reuse the earlier walls, it tells you that 200 years does erode the walls. So 400 years surely would have. Well, that makes sense. And then, just for grins, I thought, you know, this is a collection of books. I used it last week. The New Encyclopedia of Archaeological Excavations in the Holy Land. Here, there's the title. Now, generally, I don't like to cite to encyclopedias. Do you know why? secondary sources. But with this set of encyclopedias, I make an exception. And I'll tell you why. The article on Old Jericho was written by Kathleen Kenyon. So I figure she's a reliable source of what her digs found. Her book, Digging Up Jericho, reads more for popular people. The encyclopedia is much more detailed for the analytical people. But even within that framework, it's easier for me to put these Xerox pages. Let me tell you what she says about this issue of Jericho. It's got some cool pictures, too. They're black and white, so I didn't put them into the PowerPoint. But this is a big trench they dug up through the tell. It's got skulls, crossbones. It's got all this stuff. But look at some of these phrases. She's talking here, and she says, the greater part of the summit of the mound suffered very severe erosions during periods in which the site was unoccupied. Do you see that? This is like not made up. The greater part of the summit of the mound suffered very severe erosions during periods in which the site was unoccupied. It's not just this area of the Middle Bronze. She's got that throughout this article. In different times when it was unoccupied, it shows over and over and over again there was serious erosion. So here's what she has to say about Joshua and here, if the fellow had bothered to read this. Jericho, therefore, was destroyed in the late Bronze Age too. It's very possible that this destruction is truly remembered in the book of Joshua. It's just archaeology can't provide the proof. Then she says that the 400 years afterwards where nobody's there, the subsequent break in occupation that's proved by archaeology is exactly what the Bible says. There was a period of abandonment during which erosion removed most of the remains of the late Bronze Age town and much of the earlier ones. She said, I saw the rainwater gullies that cut deeply into the underlying levels. It's not a romantic mirage, but here's what's happened in the literature. Someone didn't read her carefully and said, Kathleen Kenyon says that the walls weren't there, that there's no evidence. And then other people don't go back and read Kathleen Kenyon. They read that fella. Well, Kathleen Kenyon said, well, Kathleen Kenyon said, well, Kathleen Kenyon, and by the time, and I've read the books, I put them in chronological order, and by the time you get to 2009, you've got fellas like Don Benjamin, probably a nice enough fella, but you've got fellas like this who are writing things as if it's just common knowledge, as if, well, everybody knows. I don't even need to footnote this. And he's just flat wrong. And it's just not good scholarship. And I bring that up because there are areas in the world where people who believe in the Bible being true and real are laughed at as superficial, uneducated Nimrods. It's a biblical term. And the arrogance of some of the academics who so look down upon those of us frustrates me when it's accompanied by sloppy scholarship. Now, you want to take it on the merits, you want to challenge my views on the merits, I'm fine with that. I'm a big boy. But don't go doing it with this type of scholarship and then look your nose down and act like the people who believe this stuff must just be poor, uneducated people. They haven't read Kathleen Kenyon. Well, actually, we have. And, you know, guys, points for home. Let me give them to you. The people shouted a great shout, and the wall fell down flat. One of the articles I've cited to you of what I did, and it was wonderful. In Practical and Theoretical Geoarchaeology, which is the area that kind of deals with this, In this book, there was a reference to the fact that earthquakes were especially prolific along the Jericho fault line in the late Bronze Age, and they found evidence of that in a number of different places. The ground was shaking. I thought, well, isn't that interesting? And bless his heart, being a good scholar, he gave me a footnote. And thanks to the wonders of the internet, I pulled the article out of Geology Magazine. And please understand, these are scholastic people that don't have anything to do with the Bible. This is not a biblical argument. We've totally taken the Bible out of the discussion. These are just scientists who deal in this as a matter of their work. They've done the studies. I've cited the original study to you with more information than he had found in, or he'd put in his book, because I ripped back and read the primary source. And I gave you the primary source. And it is an incredible study that indicates that in that area of the Mediterranean world, there was a time of earthquake storms, rapid successive earthquakes, and specifically in the area of Jericho, within this exact 50-year time frame that we're looking at for Joshua. It's amazing. I don't know that God used an earthquake. He could have done it any way he wants to. The Bible doesn't tell us. But I will tell you what it does say. The people shouted a great shout and the walls went down flat, just like Joshua said. Now here's your point for home, a little curveball. But I suspect some of us are going through changes in life. May not be as big as Moses to Joshua, but you may be wondering if God's really there and if God's still behind it and if God's got you where he had you. And I just want to give you this reminder as an assurance. God went to great lengths to show the Israelites that he would be fighting their battles in Cana. Very first one out of the chute. As life changes, always seek your answers from the one who doesn't change, because he's got them and he cares for you. Point for home two. James says, "Not many of you should become teachers, my brothers, for you know that we who teach will be judged with greater strictness." And Steve and I were communicating through email about this, I guess, yesterday. And we were talking about how important this verse is beyond not simply those who stand up and teach, but to all of us. Because we learn more watching people than we do listening to some lawyer. And people watch you. And you teach by how you live. And so I think this applies to all of us. Now I want to tell you where I land on it. Do I land on this as, oh, I'm so thankful I'm a really good scholar and not a slough off who doesn't know how to do footnotes? No. Because I'm sure I make a boatload of mistakes too. So this to me is a humility point. This is one of, hey, be careful how you live and what you say and how you judge and how you teach. We don't want to be teachers who are high and mighty. We want to be teachers who try hard, who give our best efforts, but carry humility with us, knowing that we are inadequate. And any good that's done is the Lord doing it through us. And that's true whether we're teaching by talking or walking. Okay? So keep humility and strive for the best in your life. Final point for home. Joshua said, "Cursed before the Lord be the man who rises and rebuilds this city Jericho." And for 400 years, Jericho lies dormant. Now, they didn't find a lot of pottery remains. I'm sure they didn't, because I'm sure over 400 years, people came and scarfed the pottery. Maybe not the Israelites, but other people. I mean, it's there for the taking. Okay? Well, I can go buy one, or I can get one free over there on the mountain. You know, the things... Okay, we don't have time for this. Here's one other interesting aspect. If the rain and the wind are coming this way, all of the eroded residue that we'd want to find stuff from, do you see where it would go? Let me remove that. They put a highway in. They have so carved that place up, you wouldn't expect to find anything. Okay? Any residue that was there would be gone anyway, the way that highway's gone in, where the residue would be. And I've given you sites for that. I didn't dream that up. Other people have said it. But here is the point for home off of it. Joshua said, cursed before the Lord be the man who rises up and rebuilds this city, Jericho. And for 400 years it lays dormant. If you want testimony, if you want testimony to the accuracy of this biblical story and the mighty hand of God, you'll find it from the fact that there are no walls. Because if it had laid dormant for 400 years and you found the walls, the archaeologists would, the archaeologists of the world would be jumping up and down saying, couldn't have happened. The walls were still there. They would have eroded in 400 years. I guarantee you they would. And they'd have science behind them. You want evidence that God's work is true? Let God's work, in your life bear His testimony. God's work is found in the ruins by the fact that it's gone. That bears out the biblical story. You want God's work in your life? Let Him do the work He's doing, and He'll get rid of all of the junk in your life too. And it's an amazing thing what happens. Would you pray with me? Lord, thank You for giving us the time this morning to be able to sit down and discuss this together. Thank You for the honor of getting to be a teacher to share this material. I pray that through my shortcomings and my mistakes and errors and problems, that You will always be able to bring truth to light. We worship You as a God of truth, a real God who really has acted in our world. We worship You as that Lord, trusting and knowing that You really act in our life today. Through Jesus Christ, amen.